Welcome to another episode of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint recap from the Center for International Maritime Security. This week, Matt and Grant are joined by Commander Salamander, the incognito juggernaut of maritime blogging. We talk about his career and sacred cows of maritime security. Remember to subscribe, advertise, and generally make a new sense of yourself until people listen to our podcast. It is awesome, and anyone who says otherwise is a liar. Now, sit back and enjoy the show.
Welcome to this week's episode of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. I am, as always, your host, Matthew Hipple, with my co-host, the Director of Operations at the Center for International Maritime Security, Grant Greenwell, and we are here this week with anonymous blogger extraordinaire, Commander Salamander, is rather prolific on the issues of naval culture, naval operations, force planning, what have you, and we're going to sort of talk to him this week about blogging, what got him started into writing about naval issues, what inspired him, sort of the issue of anonymity. And Grant also dual hats here as a administrator at the Sailor Bob Forum, so we're going to talk a little bit about that and that experience as well. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having me aboard.
Thanks, Matt.
All right, well, Commander Salamander, let me start out with a question to you. A lot of our listeners are probably familiar with your work, but if you kind of want to introduce in your own words what you do and maybe when you started and what inspired you to get involved as a writer on naval affairs.
Sure. Well, amazing, but you know, over time things really haven't changed that much. For those that have been over to my home blog, cdrsalamander.blogspot.com, yes, I'm too cheap to pay for my own URL, so I take the free stuff. They can go over to the historical archive and go over to June or July 2004 when I started blogging, and it's kind of remained the same. You know, back in 2004, it was the mill blogosphere was really still kind of limited. There's only a few people out there. And I remember being just, you know, thrilled as can be when, wow, 20 people read my ramblings in one day. I thought that was really big. But it started off really as kind of a therapy for me. I had actually written under my actual name, back in the late 90s about some things that I were involved with on sea duty. And I found myself coming back from the initial part of Operation Enduring Freedom, where myself and some of my cohorts really did some neat stuff that I wanted to write about. And I was told, no, you won't write about that because that's different. Luckily, some other people outside of our community who really weren't involved in what we did talk about what we did and were able to have an interesting conversation, which was nice to see. And I also found myself in a position where I was directed to help edit other people's work who wanted publishing to make sure that their writing was in line with top-level guidance. And I found that very distasteful. So I was kind of limited from writing on what I thought was important. And I was actually part of the problem, vice to solution, but I was a good officer. I followed orders. Nothing was illegal, just irritating. And so I just started writing. The ironic thing was, and I still haven't online ever wrote about the things that I really knew the most about, partially because I wasn't supposed to write about them. But also, once I started writing about it, it would out me immediately. And I think if I was starting to blog in 2013, I might have done things a little different. But in 2004, I had been bouncing around under a couple of different pseudonyms and a couple of the usual suspects places that you did in 2003, 2004, when I just went over to my blog because I decided that I just wanted to put my stuff out there and not have it be buried by 1,001 comments. I took the step that I took and wrote about pretty much everything else but that, never really intending that it would get much of an audience. And, you know, I mentioned it was a small world. I remember cross-linking and exchanging emails and discussing at the time kind of, a lack of a better, my blog father, who unfortunately within the last month he got sick of it and he quit. John Donovan of the Castle Arg, who is just a great man and a great gentleman. And I used to comment over at his place before I assumed my Mark Twain to my Samuel Clemens, so to speak. There was Greyhawk, who was kind of the elder statesman, who was a senior NCO in the Air Force. We found out later when he fully came out of the closet. And there was Lex, of course, who left us very unfortunately here in the last couple of years. Who was really great, because Lex was one of the first people that I actually communicated with, and he and I were actually working on a project together when he died in the aircraft accident. There was Joel over at the Stupid Shall Be Punished, who was covering the submarine side of the equation. Joel's still plowing along. He's another great gentleman. Of course, my co-host over at our show, Midrats, Eagle One, he was about. And then later on, a couple other people came into the equation. Everybody's favorite iconoclast in blood pressure razor, Skippy San from over at Far East Cynic, he came in as well. It was a small world. And I just started typing away. And like I said back in that first post, if nothing else, it was free therapy. And that led into a broader discussion. And it really did become a little more than I thought it would, as the marketplace of ideas really was a marketplace of ideas and different avenues of discussion and different topics came up, and it just kind of developed a momentum from there.
You know what? You kind of brought up a point, and something I'm curious about is you talk about guys like Joel and John, and they're kind of out. You know, they've come out just out of curiosity, not to say anything one way or the other, but you're still anonymous. I think you have mentioned before that you are retired. Well, mm-hmm. why not just come out and say who you are? I'm not asking you to do it right here. I'm just kind of curious as to what the logic is. I mean, maybe it's something you've gotten used to and it's the way that you do business, right. But something it seems like the blogosphere, at least the marketplace of ideas, it's a lot less cutthroat than it once was, and people can't necessarily touch you like they once could. So why the decision to stay the salamander?
Oh, well, you know, it's great, the highly enlightened cowardice of the anonymous commentator. It's funny, I'm not completely in the closet anymore. There's actually a not too insignificant universe of people who know everything about me, though I do keep it kind of quiet. Now, I did retire in 2009. That's no big secret. And, you know, part of it, I think, I'm comfortable with my Mark Twain persona per se, some of its marketing. I do have no problem, coming out in an appropriate venue and going, oh yeah, yeah, here's my name. Here's my background. What I do in civilian life, lucky for me, has absolutely nothing to do with the government or the military. So part of it is intellectual inertia, and part of it is marketing. And the other part of it is, you know, what do I gain by, you know, fully coming out like, you know, Matt Burton over at Black Five, who I didn't mention earlier, who was also very instrumental in many, or, you know, Eagle One Half. I actually have on a couple of occasions, was going to just plain old come out in the right venue at the right time, very low key in the background. But due to my real world, responsibilities as a civilian, I wasn't able to go to this, this gathering. And so I'm waiting for the next opportunity, and then it'll just be an, oh, by the way. Another thing that I think also it gets me, and this may not be real accurate, and it may sound a little bit arrogant, or however you want to describe it, but I think one advantage of being my persona, being Sal, which through my life I've been called all sorts of different names, or having one other name doesn't bother me one way or the other, is the discussion is about the topic. It's about the idea. It's not about the person. I get personally attacked as Sal all the time, But what I found is interesting is that usually doesn't get as much inertia as it might otherwise. Though I think the utility of staying anonymous really has outlived its usefulness. I'm just waiting for the right venue to just completely roll out executive summary, perhaps, as a fact I'm lazy. But yeah, I'm not completely. I was completely in the closet. This is I don't know whether it's an interesting story, but it's a funny story. I was very tight with how I ran everything. I think the first time anybody even heard my voice was when I was doing one of those blogger roundtable call-in things that the people over at DOD did. I came in there speaking of John Donovan. He tipped me off to it. I even forgot what the topic was. But that was it. But I was real meticulous about, where I sent my emails, going through various ways to cover IP addresses. But I haven't been that detailed about it in a very, very, very long time. And on a few occasions when I need to get books and or I need to communicate to other people or somebody just over a beer asked me straight up, what is it? I'm more than happy to share it. But the first time anybody actually came out was at in Vegas at the a convention right after I retired, where I was at a table with Greyhawk, his lovely wife, Matt Burden, Chuck Ziegenfuss, and a couple other, Troy was there, a few other dogs and cats who I hope they'll forgive me for not mentioning who they were. And Greyhawk's wife looked at me and she was like, you know, that's just stupid. And so I gave her my retired ID so she could actually see who I was. So executive summary, institutional laziness and inertia.
That's, it's a fair point. And you bring up a good point about, it's interesting, Claude Berube, I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Berube, Berube, that's a good one.
Oh,
Berube, Berube. His
first name spoken, I've never, as I was about to say, I was like, crap, I've never heard his last name. Is he and a few others got attacked a while back, and I forget who it was, by a writer, and it became personal. And you bring a good point in, is that, and which makes a lot of sense, is that your anonymity isn't really, you say it's institutional laziness, but it almost is a better way in some ways of communicating because it keeps it about your ideas. But you brought up a point earlier. You said if you were starting in 2013, you would have done it differently. What would you have done differently? And looking at us, a bunch of wild-ass kids running around saying all right. sorts of things out in the open – how do you think it's different now than it was then, better and worse?
Wow. Let me tell you the downside. If I had, whether then or now, if I came out as me, because of the people I worked for, even if I never touched a community topic that I was working on at the time, probably within minutes of a couple people finding out, I would have been called into the boss's office and have been told to cease and desist. And if I wanted to publish anything, it would have to be screened through him. Regardless of what the topic was, I could do cat blogging. And because my name was associated with the person it would be associated with, it would need to be cleared. And I'm personally speaking, not professionally, just as the way I was brought up in my mindset, which is kind of humorous for a guy that was a career naval officer. I am a radical libertarian, free speech guy. I'm in love with a representative republic, and I don't think even the military in a representative republic, I think, should be very egalitarian and should be a free range, and it's not. So even if I didn't have that happen to me, I would have purposely avoided certain subjects, which you cannot win on, regardless of your research, the validity of your topic, the validity of your opinion, or even just the neutral, you think this, I think that. If you don't hit exactly the prescribed opinions, and I've seen it happen to other people, you will be professionally destroyed. whether passively or passive aggressively, or just playing to your face, to the forehead. And if I hadn't been anonymous, just to use one example. Early on in my blog career, a lot of people are familiar with the Lieutenant Black scenario at the Naval Academy. And that's when I realized the power of being anonymous, because if I had been out of the closet completely on active duty, I could not have engaged and brought to a higher level what I saw as a huge show trial and injustice for an individual. And I'm not claiming complete credit on this by any stretch of the imagination. Matter of fact, I wouldn't have found out about it if it wasn't for my friend Skippy, who gave me the initial hint of what was going on with Admiral Rimp's tenure at the Naval Academy. But working with a few other people, both above board and in the background, we were able to raise a profile. And like a lot of things, under the light of day, an injustice cannot stand. And he was given a little bit of leeway there, and was given an honorable route that was eventually taken over at the Navy Yard. I never would have engaged with that under my actual name, because it just wouldn't have been able to take place. So that's the one of my martyrdom skins I'll take for the anonymity. But what is better about it? I think even if you're anonymous, people can judge who you are and what your opinions are. And an anonymous fool will be ignored. An anonymous person with bad information will quickly be sidelined. And on the internet, you can type out 3,000 words a day, but if only two people read it because you're obviously a fraud, then it's not gonna go anywhere. And that's one of the advantages, disadvantage. The advice for today, if somebody was going out and wanted to write, I think what you're doing at SimSec is really good. I think when done properly and with not as much aggressive verbiage that is easy to do online, I think some of the more touchy subjects can be addressed in person. But I would advise anybody using their actual name, absolutely positively avoid all social issues. Stick to the tactical, stick to the theory, and tread lightly on anything that is socio-political, because regardless of how accurate you believe your ideas are, and if 99 out of 100 people in a room agree with you, it is that one person in the room who disagrees with you that can very well, without you even knowing it, completely derail your career plans. I've seen it happen. People just need to be very careful when they're out there with their own name, what they're writing about. I know Admiral Stavridis and Admiral Harvey, when they were active duty, they were very much encouraging people to write. And I think they represent a minority opinion of people out there that I think, as long as you're respectful, regardless of the topic that you are writing about, that I think you could address it and you'd be okay with those individuals. However, if you are not working for one of those individuals, or if there's a chance that you may in the future work for somebody who does not share that attitude, then you just need to be very careful what topics that you address. There's a lot of things you can write about. Baldy Locks told me once at a conference something that I think is very good. She didn't tell me, she's telling a group of people. It's like, you don't have to write about everything. You shouldn't write about everything. Pick the handful of topics that you're willing to jot something out in the course of having a cup of coffee or being on hold that other people might find interesting, and focus on those. But don't feel like you have to engage on everything. And so my advice to somebody who was coming into the marketplace of ideas and was going to write under their own name, I'd get a sheet of paper. I'd write, here are the 10 things I really care about that I can pop out my opinions on a regular basis, if in short notice if needed. Boil those down and look at the few that could get you destroyed, and maybe leave those for somebody else to do who's in a position to be able to address those topics. I don't know if that answered your question or not. I kind of went down a rabbit hole. Sorry about
no,
that.
No, no, it absolutely answers the question. And you know what? I'm glad you mentioned that piece at the end. Dan Moore gave a great presentation at DEF, and one of his points was with Boyd. He brought up, don't get killed in a good battle. And he was talking about, it's tangentially, it was Boyd's personal life, which just was left by the wayside and destroyed. But why, you know, why would you go out there and plant your flag on a hill that you know you could die on when at the end of the day you could fight on so many other hills and win? I thought that was really a good point that he made. But I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to throw it actually over here to Grant. So, Commander Salamander, you're the battleship here. Grant, you're the force multiplier. You're the guy, you're an admin over at Sailor Bob. You deal with a lot of people talking about a lot of those napkin, jotting ideas down on a napkin, Commander Salamander, and what we do at SimSec is a lot more long form. What's that like? What have you been involved with, and how? What's that been like for you?
Well, it's actually kind of funny because the commander brought up a case at the Naval Academy that was at the time very controversial, and it was a case of an officer who was kind of getting the short end of the stick over some stuff that happened, and I was tied into it to a certain extent, and I really needed some professional advice from some adult supervision in the Navy. And there was nobody there to really kind of help me out at the time. I couldn't get any help from company officer, battalion officer, you know, and I certainly wasn't about to go ask the admiral. And so I really needed some kind of a venue to reach out to somebody and say, hey, I definitely need some help. And I found that help in the form of an online forum, kind of a blog forum called SailorBob.com, which I think most people who are involved in the Navy, specifically the surface warfare community, are familiar with it. It's an online forum where you can go ahead and you have a handle, you know, similar to back in the days of CB radio, and you know, so it does maintain a level of anonymity. And you can go ahead and post questions, thoughts, comments about anything. Literally, I mean, I'm looking at the stats now. We've got 3,300 members, 95,000 posts. For 3,200 different topics. And so if you go in and we've almost created our own lessons learned database, you can go in here and you can search, through the forum, and it's PHP format and say, hey, how do I figure out the reference for how to tow another destroyer? And it's probably in there somewhere or somebody has pointed to it. And there's a lot of different ideas that get thrown out in there. A lot of different categories of forums. There's fun forums, like one of the particularly fun ones to watch is the election ones, and talking about the elections that are coming up and what's the implications for the government, for the military. There's fun ones about you know, who's going to win. Is it going to be the Red Sox this year, whatever? But then there's a lot of professional stuff, which is really kind of the meat and potatoes of Sailor Bob. You know, for instance, we talk there's a specific section designed for division officers, where division officers can go in there and say, hey, these are the references that really help with my qualification, or here's some helpful hints. And that's not limited just to new division officers. We've actually broken it up into there's a separate forum just for JOPA, the Junior Officer Protections Association, where only O1s through O3s can post in that forum and see that forum. So if, you know, for instance, an O1 says, hey, man, my captain is really kind of being a jerk on my ship, there's no way for that captain or in the department heads really to look at that forum, try and figure out who that incident is, and then nail them. So there is a degree of trust that's built in there. And it's not limited just to JOPA either. There's also a new XOCO Protection Society in there, where XOs and COs can bounce their thoughts and ideas off of each other. Hey, what would you do in this case? Would you take the guy to mast, or would you just counsel him? Hey, what do you guys think about the Christmas lighting plan? What do you do in this situation? So a lot of good things going on with Sailor Bob nowadays. I just really can't say enough, because even from being a midshipman, I was able to reach out and get the advice of a very senior and well-respected commander at the time, who came back immediately within 20 minutes and said, hey, I read your post about you needed some help. I'm here. Here's my phone number. Here's my email address. Let's get together as quickly as possible. And I think you see that kind of thing a lot on Sailor Bob. And I'm not sure, just, you know, harkening back to what the commander was saying, I'm not sure that you'd be able to have that level of freedom if everybody was posting by their name, by their rank, by their position. And I can honestly say that because of the anonymity provided in SailorBob, and you know, a lot of other people in the forum can testify to this, members of SailorBob have literally made huge changes in the Navy for the better. I can't say enough about it. Stand by for questions.
Sal, you got anything for him?
No, I think he hit on the right thing. And you got to give some credit to some of the senior leaders who got new technology, new media, excuse me, and got Sailor Bob and other venues and were able to look back and look past the anonymity. I've actually had, you know, some of the old bulls have actually had some interesting, you know, back and forth with, who really do not like the anonymous point, and we just had an agreement to disagree on that respect. But they've reached out on Sailor Bob, and that really started about 4 years ago when the initial nibbles come in. I've had some really neat emails, with some senior leaders who, you know, want to exchange emails on background, and I like to think that that happens not just with me, but it happens with some other players too. And I think that's one thing that is kind of neat, is it's an avenue, I think, for senior decision makers, who we all know when we reach a certain point, most people they run into tell them what they think they want to know. They don't give them the bad news. They don't give them the contrary opinion. And sometimes if they find somebody that they can talk about some things in confidence, they'll do that. It's also been kind of neat. Some of those individuals have come up and said, oh, by the way, this that you put up this morning, you're completely wrong. Didn't hear it from me, but XYZ 123. And a couple of people who have seen on my post corrections or updates, it's been because somebody who, really has the right angle has tapped me on the shoulder and go, you read this from the article and they really didn't report how the interview went correctly. Here's my notes from the interview. This may, color how your thoughts of it. And that's really helpful too. Grant's exactly right about the Sailor Bob format. It's kind of the, back in the day, the old green log books, the esoteric books of gouge that JOs would keep, but you're kind of limited to what you could get in your own command. Sailor Bob, when used right, along with a couple of other venues, I think has really helped the Navy writ large, but really I think has helped build a hive mind of really sharp, inquisitive junior officers who really want to serve and do their job as best as possible. And by being able to tap into other people's experience, they're able to get a step or two higher pretty fast, where in the past it would take a while until you found the right person with the right bit of information that could help you step up your game a little bit as a professional. It's been a great asset, especially in an unclassed venue like it is.
Yeah, and just another thing too on that, like you said, I mean, the whole architecture of Sailor Bob is due solely to Sailor Bob Actual, who built a website, like you said, 4, 5, 6 years ago when he was a department head student going through. And he built the whole thing, and it's largely because of Sailor Bob and then also Anathema, those two main guys in particular who really have contributed a lot to that. But there's another aspect to it as well, kind of emerging, and that's ethics. A lot of discussions on what is ethical, what is not ethical. And I think, a really good point to that is we have one member, Hot Metal, out there who is rewriting the Ethics for Junior Officers manual because he said, hey, a lot of that doesn't apply. A lot of the case studies are similar to what we would see nowadays. Junior officers are thirsting for good ethics. We can get it online, but what happens if you can't get to the internet and if you can't get to Sailor Bob? We'll take all this, we'll put it together, we'll put it in a book. So a lot of great things going on there with Sailor Bob, all because of the ease of use, anonymity, and some good guys who started it with good conscience, just like yourself, sir.
I'll admit, I'm kind of new. I've only started this in the past 2 years writing. SimSec, we try to bring in more of the international angle. USNI looks at, hey, U.S. Navy, U.S. Maritime Affairs. We try to inform ourselves by finding the perspective of the other people. Grant, in your experience, looking at Sailor Bob, do you ever get the encounter of maybe guys from other navies trying to join in too that have heard about Sailor Bob and Sal. Have you had a lot of experience with foreign bloggers, guys bringing ideas from over the other side of the pond, maybe bringing their perspective in as well? And
yeah, for the Sailor Bob side of the house, we do have some foreign entities. We try to keep them. I wouldn't say four eyes, but you know, we try to keep most of it in-house to the U.S., U.K. as much as possible, because we do touch on a lot of things there that get pretty close to the edge of releasability and classification issues. We do have, I think there's three different U.K. Naval officer members on there right now. We've also got a lot of SIVMARs and a lot of GSs.
There are a couple guys that comment on my home blog, but also ones that you can see on a regular basis on the chat room over at the Eagle One and I's little chat spot at Midrats, and also some emails I exchanged that I wish there were more international people engaged in. But there's a Turkish naval officer I'm in regular communications with. I also have a couple of civilians from Belgium, the Netherlands, Poland, Pavel, on a very regular basis. Good to get that Central European point of view. Also the CO of one of the Spanish, Perry class, their version of the Perry class, who's also an AV-8 pilot. He and I exchange emails on a regular basis. I think it's real important to get those kind of international, perspectives. And that's one thing that I've looked for, and a lot of it has to do again with, you know, relative population size. You know, America, 315 some odd million. Denmark, 5 million. Yeah, there's economies of scale. Looking online for an international version of what we do, unfortunately, I think it maybe is a cultural thing. Who knows? I wish there was more, because there's some really smart professional naval professionals out there. Anybody that spent time on a British warship, with the Dutch Navy, even the French and the German navies, you come back there just shaking your head, wishing you could adopt a lot of their ideas. I wish we could engage them more. I think, especially, Shem, the Turkish naval officer, he's, very, very good to get his view, from that part of the world. I wish we had more of that going on, you know, our own little version of the thousand ship navy, so to speak.
It's interesting, and I'm glad you've had that experience. The one country I do know a little bit about that I thought it was interesting, Sal, when you talk about culture, is the Australians. I think a lot of us complain on the U.S. side, like maybe that we don't have the freedoms that we wish that we had. But you look at other stuff like the blogosphere, and I've actually had a few exchanges with some Australian officers, and I've asked them about blogging, and it turns out that the Australians, of all people, seem very freewheeling, don't allow it, period. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe this is only a policy with some units in the Australian military, but there is like a kibosh on them, and a few of them are trying to change that policy now, using the example of what a lot of us do. You know, there's USNI, Sal, there's you, there's SimSec, there's War on the Rocks, a lot of other blogs. But, you know, it's always surprising to find those cultures and maybe appreciate that what we have is a lot better than maybe what we appreciate at first. Before we move on, either you guys have any closing observations? Grant, you have any questions that I haven't hit?
Yeah, sure. When are you going to retire from blogging, sir?
Me?
Never.
Well, you know, it's funny. I actually when last month when John walked away from ARG, it was for a blogger, at least it was a little bit of an existential moment. And I've done this a few times where I've stepped back and go, do I really want to keep doing this? It's, you know, it sure as hell doesn't pay any money. But it's always good to reassess. Regardless of what you're doing, whether it's whether you're writing, playing guitar, like one of the best things I ever did was quit playing golf. You know, I spent my whole life doing it. To reassess what you do, what you're investing your time in, and to make a self-assessment. is it worth it to you and those things you care about to continue doing something? Is it contributing both to yourself and to the larger society around you? And if you can answer yes to both of those, then keep doing it. And I'm still answering yes to that. So I think I'll keep doing it. And I run into this in civilian life and my family life on a regular basis. You know, people say, do you miss it? It being active duty, it being the military. And I said, I miss it every single day. I miss the people that I served with. And I missed the culture and the integrity and the view that people take towards it. But in life's little matrix, it was time for me to go. And so by continuing to blog and to keep in touch, I'm able to still, in a way, stay engaged into what is really my passion. I'm just not on active duty anymore. So I don't plan on quitting anytime soon unless I decide I want to just completely fall off the grid, which I do on occasion, but I'm not going anywhere, I don't think.
Great. Glad to hear that, sir.
Let's move on. This week, we just had our Sacred Cows Week, and I think it'd be appropriate to open up the floor. Grant, you're working on a few articles. Of course, we're recording this midweek. We make no pretensions about this thing being live. And Sal, you of course are a man of many well-informed opinions about sacred cows. Maybe if each one of you could present possibly something you think is a sacred cow. It doesn't have to be a U.S. sacred cow. It could even be a foreign military. We've got an article that came out about the U.K. regimental system versus their Marines and how they do their training. But something that you think maybe we can learn from, and a sacred cow that maybe needs to be slaughtered.
I'll defer to the commander first.
Oh, very nice. Thank you. Throw me into the breach. Wow. I think it's a great entering argument. When I was looking at your sacred cow, and first of all, I love the topic that y'all covered about are we paid too much, and talking about the retirement pay. When we had one of the last Mill blog conferences, I think it was the spring of 2010 in D.C., they had a group of people up there from the Hill. And I decided to be the skunk at the picnic and brought up, I lived overseas for quite a few years and served with a lot of foreign military officers. So I had a brief understanding of how their pay scales and pay systems work that we're probably going to, especially from a retirement point of view, and brought up that exact topic about pay and benefits, especially the retirement program. And they didn't want to touch it with somebody else's 10-foot pole. So I thought that was a great sacred cow to kind of throw out there, because it always going to throw off some sparks, but it's an important topic. But a couple things. One, it's close to that, and the other one is kind of a point of argument. One thing that I pride myself is in my 21 years of active duty, I never lived on base. I still think that living on base is, except when there is no other option, not only I think is it a waste of resources on the whole, but I think it's bad for the military and for the country we serve, that we should live in our own little universe, in our own little planet, especially officers, but officers enlisted, everybody, they should be living in the society in which they serve. You should not be living in your own little private Idaho behind the gates. You need to be out there. Plus, with how few people actually serve in the military, if your next door neighbor is an E5 with three kids, you're able to appreciate those challenges when they disappear for 6 to 12 months at a time. If the CO of the local base lives across the street from you and their kids babysit yours, you get exposure to the military and the issues. So I would love to see on-base housing go away as much as it possibly could, or at least cut by 80%. I also think intellectually from our side, I still find it very humorous reading all the shipbuilding reports coming across. People just aren't paying attention. We need more people with degrees in economics, graduate degrees in economics on OPNAV staff. Anybody that's looking at long-range planning, if you're planning to have a fleet of more than 250 coming out of the 2020s, you're not thinking right. We need to be thinking 250 and below. We need to talk about not what we wish we could do, but we got fat and lazy, and we've designed a Tiffany Navy that we're going to have to digest here until we get different ship classes and processes moving. We're going to have to live with the results of a decade and a half that was lost and based upon unrealistic assumptions in the economy we have right now. I would like to see a lot more discussions about a fleet of 250 and less and how we do that coming out of the 2020s. Those are my two sacred cows.
Well, you know what? You actually just convinced me. I was always one of those guys that thought about, we have all this housing on base. Why aren't we using it? And I know I live off base, but it seems like a waste of money. But you bring up a really good point about the connection of people with the society they live in. And also, earlier this week, we actually had a first-class midshipman, Michael Madrid. He brought up that issue of the Tiffany Navy in a way when he wrote his article, Quantity Over Quality, kind of talking about quantity in the pure sense, but sort of hitting around like battleship style, the board game, not the actual battleships, towards Zumwalt's kind of high-low idea, which, you know, if only the actual Zumwalt itself would fit into that program, but, you know, that's another story for another day. We ranted about that enough the last podcast, but all right, Grant, I'm going to open up to the floor. I see you filling the chat thing here at the bottom with your ideas, so go ahead.
Yeah, I was just making a list of stuff that I would kill off. I know you said don't mention it, but I just wanted to go on record. LCS, I kind of see as maybe a sacred calf. Maybe not a sacred cow yet, but a calf.
I feel like that's a dead horse. It's not a sacred cow.
So I'm sure.
Yeah, I think Senator McCain's going to have fun with it here pretty soon.
Yeah. You know, of course, I could talk to you about how GHSV should be the new LCS, but we'll save that for another podcast. We talked a little bit on the last podcast about the amphibious force, how we really need to take a good, strong look at, you know, what we're doing with the 33 ships, 36 ships, 31 ships. What's the capability we need to maintain it? And I wouldn't say that we need to slaughter that cow, but we definitely need to, you know, put it up in a pen somewhere. I'm actually a pretty big advocate of taking our amphibious force and combining them with the maritime preposition forces. I wish we still had three squadrons, but the two that we have now, and leaving our amphibious capability over in those locations and making those in conjunction with those two. I think the only impact that you would have there is maybe the impact on what amphibs are doing for soft power at this point. If you went to annual exercises based out of Amphitrons 2 and 3, I think you'd still get the same amount of capability and training value as you currently do and save a lot. Another community that I would kill, and I hate to say it because I was part of that community for a long time, is the VR community, C9, C40, C12s. I keep that mission completely over to the Air Force and also to the commercial side of the house. Is that a boot from?
Yeah, that was the commander.
I completely agree with Commander Salamander about the numbers. You know, we cannot sustain what we have now. Still say stretch as thin as we are and maintain our ships. No way that we're going to get to the 30 and 40 year shelf lives of these ships that we want to with the numbers that we're putting out right now. And kind of to that point, I think one thing that America as a whole takes for granted is, you know, a sailor goes away in March and he comes back 6 months later. I'm not sure that that's the right answer. I think we should take a look at extending those deployments, trying to see what the maintenance costs are going to be in the long run. If we extend a ship from 6 months to 9 months, how much more time on station can we get? Especially when you're talking ships going over to the Gulf area and they're losing a month on either side of the deployment. So maybe if we extend that and make 9 months the standard or 8 months the standard. And kind of the big thing for me personally is how much it costs to get things done when it comes to implementing new systems. So, for instance, one thing that's near and dear to my heart is electronic navigation. Dealt with it when I was a midshipman, went to the first all-electronic navigation ship in the fleet, Cape St. George, and I just saw how painful the process was and how expensive the process was to go ahead and take a commercial off-the-shelf system and try and militarize it and then do it poorly. All the while, you've got the guys who actually built the system at Sperry, now Northrop Grumman, in agony, seeing what's being done to their system, wishing they could help us, and just seeing the cost go through the roof because the guys who built and designed the system are former SWOs like us. So if there was a way to go ahead and cut out a lot of the testing, cut out a lot of making it mil-spec, and say, hey, you know what, if it fails, here's the backup, here's the replacement for it, just throw in another one. I think we need to take a look at our systems and see if there's a way to replace that. And I see there's a note in here, GPS hard down a technology has allowed tactically effective non-nuclear EMP weapons, fight and win. Yeah, absolutely right, sir. There needs to be ways to supplement GPS. I think that we've got a couple options available to us, first being the wide area augmentation system when we're close to the shore. We did have Loran, Charlie, Brits and the rest of Europe and even Russia have adapted that to make it enhance Loran. Unfortunately, the administration decided, even though it was more expensive to shut down the Loran stations than to upgrade it to eLoran, we just get rid of that. I'm a huge proponent of bringing back eLoran and making that as a backup navigation system for us. Also, when you're close to land or if you can still take sites, you can still use an electronic charging system to go ahead and properly plot ship's position even without GPS. So if there was a way to make it cheaper, that'd be great. And I really feel probably the cheapest and strongest asset in the fleet is that 18, 19-year-old sailor you got coming from the streets. Because they probably got a lot of the right answers. It's just going to cost a lot to implement it if we send it through the Navy system as it stands now.
You know, you guys are bringing up a good point with the GPS. I think a lot of the one big sacred cow that we all dance around is that data uplinks and using that global positioning system. Is we threw away DISMAC and TURCOM a long time ago, but those are the kinds of things we probably need to bring back. A little while ago, Scott and I were writing a few articles about, hey, what's weird ways that we can use drones. But if you had a drone that knew where it was in relation to map, you could build secondary GPS systems, you know, and stuff like that. We should probably work a little bit more on those areas. And, of course, we beat cyber to death last time. But Sal, you brought up the point down here in the chat of ending equal budgets. Now, Mr. Scold wrote an article for us this week that was pretty good. One of his points for the 8 reality checks for defense strategy was the United States is an air and maritime power that keeps acting like a land power. Maybe you could talk a little further on that idea of ending equal budgets.
Yeah, and I think it's Secretary of Defense Hagel has made some motions in this direction and has made a few comments about it. But when all else fails, take out a bloody chart and look at it. We are not a continental land power. We've got Canada to the north, Mexico to the south. We have a tradition in this country, barely within living memory, actually kind of out of living memory in the last decade or so, where the preponderance of our land power was in the what is now called the National Guard in the states, a relatively low condition of readiness, but when you need them, you can call them up, you can augment them. Is that the ideal? No, but we're not Sparta and we're not 19th century Prussia. We're a nation with a military, not a military that has a nation. And if you're looking to mitigate global national security risks for a nation like us, the good Lord and our English forebears have blessed us with some pretty darn good geography. Big ocean to the west, big ocean to the east. Even in hypersonic flight and intercontinental ballistic missiles, you know, space still gives you time and distance. We can do what we need to do economically and militarily by emphasizing those things that help with our own version of the porcupine strategy. Naval and air and space forces can do a lot for us. An army, if you need it, you can keep and you can build up and you can scale that. It's a lot easier to scale an army than it is to scale a fleet. That's just a fact. And I think if you're willing to accept some of that risk, are we planning on engaging in a major land war in Asia? I sure hope not. Could we help some allies who are engaged in the land war in Asia with air and maritime assets? Probably. But we can't afford, not so much economically. You know, hey, if we wanted to get rid of Schedule D Medicare, and if you wanted to get rid of a few other things, yeah, you can have a bigger military. But we also have to look at it politically. The American public don't have an interest in spending any more money than they already are at the military. Matter of fact, they're interested in spending a lot less. So we need to be smart about how we're going to spend what the people's representatives give us in the military budget. And the best way to do that is to invest your money on what is capital intensive and hard to build up, and mitigate your risks in other areas by accepting land forces at a lower state of readiness, and go back to what we traditionally like. You know, that's one of the neat things about the founding of this nation, what makes us a little different. We have in our blood an inherent distrust of large standing armies. That's fine with me. We can scale it up if we need to. And there are actually some – it's not completely a parochial thing. I think history and economics – backs that up. It's the right thing to do.
Grant, you got anything?
No, sir.
Well, you know, right before we sort of kick it off at the end here, we were talking about the large standing army. If you haven't seen the trailer for Dragon Day, don't go see the movie. It looks terrible. But basically, the Chinese managed to, in a cyber attack, take down all of the electronics in the United States. Not take them down, but rather all the microchips that were produced in China sort of hijack in this weird pseudo Skynet way all of the United States. And then in the trailer, you start seeing guys in army, U.S. Army uniforms that are clearly from the U.S. running around with like these Chinese armbands and like gathering people up. And I was telling my buddy from the army, I was like, you know what? Like, I get the fact that we're all obsessed with our smartphones, but I feel like, you know, the guys in green aren't gonna, the second they can't play Angry Birds without, you know, submitting themselves to communism, are just gonna lay down their arms and start collecting people into camps. I was like, yeah, this is kind of like Red Dawn, but I don't know if this is gonna be even worse than the betrayal that was the awful remake. Thanks, Grant. Grant commented that he knew I would work it in. It is an absolutely repugnant and horrible trailer. Do you guys have any final comments, final thoughts before we close it out here?
Grant, why don't you go over to you?
Well, you know, we hit a little bit on sacred cows, and you know, I think my points were not nearly as good as Matt's or the commander's, but I think a place that you can, you know, discuss all this in kind of a free form is what we already hit up on the blog, on the internet, and be having these conversations. Commander Sal already did a tip of the hat to Admiral Harvey and Admiral Stavridis, saying, hey, young folks need to get out there reading, writing, and doing it. And I think that this is exactly the way that you need to be doing it. I mean, read and write on the internet, get as much knowledge as you can, and then when somebody's silly enough to ask you, would you comment on it and put it on a podcast, say absolutely yes, because then you find yourself in great company like with Matt and the commander.
You know, you say that you know, our points are better, but Sun Tzu says when strong look weak, so I know the game that you're playing, Grant.
Hey, if I could piggyback on what Grant said, because the illustrious Mrs. Salamander and I were actually talking about this a while ago, and you know, the old Woody Allen phrase that, you know, half a life is just showing up. That's really not true, because you have to show up with something. But when it comes to the marketplace of ideas, if you don't like what you hear, if you don't like what's being discussed, get in there, write, put your opinion out there, practice at it. The more you do it, the better you get, in framing your arguments. But there are a lot of people who have great ideas, great thoughts and strong opinions, and they never leave the four walls, so they're never heard. If you would be surprised when you walk into the marketplace of ideas how open it can be, the connections you'll make, the power that your word can have and your ideas can have simply by you stepping into a space that you didn't even know was vacant and open. But it is. It's vacant. It's open. Don't sit there in hem and haw. Go out there, engage, write, get the conversation going. I think both of y'all have heard me say before, You don't have the right answer. I don't have the right answer either. You know what? The guy with four stars over there, he doesn't either. But if everybody is having a conversation and is having a little bit of that creative friction without excessive conflict, you move the ball closer to what the right answer is, and especially in the national security arena or just our maritime arena, by having that conversation, by having that creative friction, by moving that point a little closer to the elusive truth, you make the service that you're part of, and you also make the nation a little bit better. So it's not just selfish. It's not just narcissistic. It has a good end result of hopefully getting things to a better place than they would be if you never engage in the conversation to begin with.
No, this has been great. Commander Salamander, you can be found at commandersalamander.blogspot.com. That's spelled CDR Salamander. You can be found on Twitter at CDR Salamander with an @ in front of it. And of course, we didn't mention it as much, but we probably should have, but you have your Midrats podcast, which is at blogtalkradio.com/midrats. Is there anything else that you want to throw in there that you want to plug? Maybe some other people that we should be listening to or some other work that might be coming up?
Wow, I don't plan that far ahead. But I really appreciate the opportunity to come on, Matt, with you and Grant. I enjoyed the conversation being on the other end of the table, and I hope I behave myself.
Oh, it has been, the pleasure's been ours. Grant, have you got anything?
Nope, just want to encourage the listeners to go ahead and keep paying attention to the SimSec website. Follow us on Twitter and also on Facebook.
Amen.
Perfect. Well, I hope everybody has enjoyed our week of Sacred Cows. We've got another week coming up where Charles Hill is going to be working on offshore patrol vehicles, and then after that we should have our week of satire. That is a date yet to be determined. As always, you can follow us at SimSec, spelled C-I-M-S-E-C, and you can find us at CIMSEC.org, and of course you can follow me on Twitter at AmericaHipple. That's all I got, gentlemen. It has been a pleasure.
Same here, gentlemen. Cheers.